Not too long ago, I went on Hulu and I found the TV show Shark Tank. And I went all the way back and watched every episode starting at season one. I've always had that entrepreneurial spirit, wanting to start businesses and make money by working for myself. And that's pretty much what I've done. I've been self-employed for more than 20 years. And now I'm self-employed as a podcaster. But one thing I've never done, I've never been on Shark Tank. But Max has, and he did it as a teenager. Max told me the whole story of the product he developed and how he pitched it on TV and ended up getting a deal with Mark Cuban. This is a flashback episode. Max originally told this story here on the podcast back on episode 18. So after he tells about his adventures on Shark Tank, you'll hear a new conversation I had with Max recently about what he's up to today. Surprise! He's started a new company. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a girl hanging by her broken leg from the telephone wire.
And I called 911 and I said, I found a baby.
I turned around. I see a gun pointed at me close enough I could touch it.
She would hold our heads underwater all the time.
He levels the gun, pulls the trigger, and I go down.
Her eyes were full of tears. She didn't want to leave us.
My hair catches on fire.
I swear to God, this image is burning my head for the rest of my life.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like?
Hey, do you have trouble sleeping? Then maybe you should check out the Sleepy Podcast. It's a show where I read old books in the public domain to help you get to sleep. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of classic stories like A Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, Winnie the Pooh. Stories that are great for adults and kids alike. For years now, Sleepy has helped millions of people catch some much-needed Z's, start their next day off fresh, and discover old books that they didn't know they loved. So, whether you have a tough time snoozing or you just like a good bedtime story, fluff up the cool side of your pillow and tune into Sleepy. Unless you're driving, then please don't listen to Sleepy. Find Sleepy on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes each week. Sweet dreams.
Listen up, true crime fans.
There's a big murder trial underway.
Dateline is launching a new podcast with Andrea Canning.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly.
We'll cover breaking crime news around the country with the best reporters on the case, NBC News analysts, and Dateline producers on the ground.
Over. Break it down for us.
You'll just get behind-the-scenes scoops from crime scenes to courtrooms.
So tell us what he said.
Listen to Dateline True Crime Weekly now and catch new episodes every Thursday.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
How long have you been watching Shark Tank?
I've been watching Shark Tank since I was probably 8 years old. So, you know, for the past 10, 11 years. Well, they're in the 10th season now, and I've been watching since the first handful of seasons. So I've been watching for a very long time.
Yeah, your episode was in season 10, right?
Yes. So we were in the 10th season, which was, it's a great season. They're doing a lot this season about, featuring stories of young entrepreneurs, because I think they're starting to realize that entrepreneurs are now growing up watching Shark Tank. And so they're it seems like they're starting to do a lot more on that end, which is very nice.
That's good.
That's great.
Yeah, I like that. When did you first have the idea for this product?
So look, when I was 15 years old, I just fell in love with coffee, right? I got so inspired by it and I just started loving it. I'm not sure why, but I started making it myself, you know, using all different types of brewing methods. I tried pour overs, AeroPresses, everything you could think about to make coffee. And eventually I stumbled across cold brew coffee. And I said, this is something I haven't tried before. It wasn't sold at Starbucks. It wasn't sold at, in any large retailers. And I said, this is something that I really want to try, because everything on the internet said it was smoother, it was sweeter, it tasted better, and it was a totally different kind of coffee than I had ever had before. And so I go online and I type in how to make cold brew coffee in YouTube. And, you know, I learned that people use mason jars to make it themselves at home all the time. And so that's exactly what I tried. I took a mason jar and I added ground coffee and cold water to it. And, you know, you let that sit in your refrigerator for 24 hours. But then what happens is you have this sludgy coffee mixture in a jar that you can't drink because you have to filter it. And so everyone online said, oh, just take a cheesecloth or a paper towel and, you know, filter it. And that's what I tried. And remember, I'm 15 years old. So I tried filtering it. It made a mess, of course, because it's not a really good way to filter something. And my parents were so mad because I was just a kid and making a mess in the kitchen. They were not happy. And they said, like, you're never allowed to do this again. You need to stop making cold brew. I said, well, okay, there has to be a better way to do this. Because if this is going to be the next kind of coffee that everyone's going to love, why is everyone going to be using this horrible way to filter it? Like, there must be a better solution. And so I had this idea for a double-sided mason jar lid with a filter in the center. And so I thought that, you know, I said that this must exist. That was my first instinct was, oh, let me go buy this. I'll find this on Amazon. So I type in double-sided mason jar lid, Google it, go on Amazon. It does not exist. I can't find it anywhere. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to make it because it's not in the market. So I'm going to make it. So I go into my garage and I grabbed a screen door and some mason jar lids and I, you know, glued together this first prototype and it worked. And after some trial and error, it started working. And so that's really how Brew was born. And I said, this is an amazing idea. It's helping me make better coffee. It must be making, you know, why can't this help everyone make better coffee? And so it's something that's stuck and that I've been continuing to work on for the past 4.5, almost 5 years.
When you first made that first prototype and you got excited about it, and obviously I can tell just by listening to you, you are excited about this thing. Were you excited because, wow, I can now make cold brew coffee? Or were you excited because, wow, I've got a product here that could potentially make a lot of money because nobody else is doing it?
I think it was a piece of both. I don't think that I was only excited because I was like, oh my God, I just struck gold. I'm going to make $1 billion, because we definitely haven't. We haven't made that much. You know, it's a good product and it's, you know, people are buying it, but we definitely haven't made millions and millions and millions of dollars yet. Hopefully that's down the road. But my first instinct was like, I want to help more people make better coffee. And I think that's, you know, going to a very macro level, I think that's what makes us really strong entrepreneurs. When you say, like, when you don't have, you know, I want to make money, 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 money at the forefront of everything, and you're driven by passion and by wanting to help other people make better coffee and other people to understand your passion, I think it, you know, can just leads to a lot more success than saying, oh, I'm going to make $1 million. I'm going to start a company. Because if that was the case, there's a lot of different ways we could have grown it, but I don't think that we would have built the community that we're building of people that enjoy using the brew and enjoy making cold brew at home.
Right. And you wouldn't probably be quite as passionate about it either.
Right, exactly.
If it was just for money. Now, you said the name of it is Brew. That's B-R-U-W. What does that mean?
So, truthfully, it's because brew.com and .net was taken, and I couldn't think of another website. So we're working on a cool backstory for the name, but as of right now, it's just like I was sitting around the kitchen table with me. It was me, I was 15, so it was me and my mom. Mm-hmm. I think my grandma was there, and my siblings were like, "We need a name for this. What should we call it?" And it was like originally going to be called Cough Me, like COFFME. That was the first name, and I thought I was like, oh, coffee, that's the best. Right, everyone's like, no way, that's horrible. And then it was Brewd, B-R-U-W-D, so it was Brewd, which you can't really say without, like, you know, it's...
You got to spell it for everybody, right?
Right? There was Brewd, there was all these other names. And so finally, someone at the table, it's either me or... I don't remember who it was, but they're like, what about Brew? And I was like, oh, that's a good name, but it must be taken. So I go online, I'm like, oh, it's available. And so we bought the website in that meeting, and, you know, the name stuck.
It's pretty incredible that a 4-letter domain name was still even available.
It's a .net, so we don't have brew.com.
Oh, okay.
We have brew.net, and we also have brewcoffee.com. So those are both really okay. Yeah, I was really lucky.
Have you talked to the .com owner at all about getting that?
They are not willing to sell it. Trust me, I've talked to them.
Wow, okay. Well, not yet. I mean, anything's for sale for the right amount of money.
Exactly.
Right? Okay. Now, I have only been familiar with hot coffee, and my wife drinks iced coffee, and I wasn't really familiar with cold brew as compared to iced coffee. Can you kind of describe? I've done a little research, so I now know, but can you describe for the listeners what the difference is?
Totally. So a cold brew coffee. So let me go back to iced coffee. Iced coffee is you make coffee and you cool it down. And you pour it over ice, right? It's pretty self-explanatory. Everyone can pretty much figure out how to make it. Not too challenging. Cold brew, on the other hand, well, so what happens is you get iced coffee, you just get coffee that's cold. You just, get a cold tasting cup of coffee. So it's not that special. Cold brew, though, you actually brew with cold water. So the coffee grounds never touch heat. They never get hot, and you do it over a longer period of time. So because you're using cold water and because you're stretching out the process, the chemical reaction with the coffee and the water, between the coffee and the water, is actually different. So you're not extracting the same amount of acidity out of the coffee bean, and you're not extracting all the same elements that you would when you have a hot cup of coffee. So it ends up being more caffeinated, and it tastes smoother and sweeter. So it doesn't taste as bitter and harsh as, that same coffee would taste if you brewed it hot. It, tastes actually completely different. And that's a big plus to a lot of people that like coffees. They said, well, I hate the bitterness. I have to add milk. I have to add cream. And when they drink cold brew, it's smoother, and they don't need to use the most expensive coffee in the world to get something that's drinkable. It's something that, it tastes good still if it's made cold. And I think that's what people like a lot. And then because of the lower acidity, certain doctors will recommend it for patients who have, have digestional issues, because it's easier on their diet. There's a whole array of benefits to it, but it is different. I mean, the main one is that it tastes different and it tastes better.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to trying it. I haven't yet had cold brewed coffee. I ordered your filter. It just hasn't arrived yet.
Right.
But I know you're a little back ordered a little bit, right?
A little bit. It's on the way. So it's everything shipping out. Well, by the time this is up airing, should probably be shipping out already. So
right, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, but it was crazy. We got all these orders the night we aired on Shark Tank, and we were expecting an influx of orders. We didn't really know how much, and we just got slammed, and we said, this is great. And then we also decided, like, okay, we need to meet this demand. We need to figure it out. And it was definitely challenging to do it, but we're slowly getting there.
Let's go into the show. You decided to be on Shark Tank. Now, I know you can, to get on the show, you can apply either online or at an open call. How did you do it?
So you can apply either online or in an open casting call. Both of them are pretty similar. They're, one you just go and speak in person in front of judges, and the other one you submit a video of yourself. And either way, you get in front of this, I believe you get in front of the same casting team, and they review you, and they pick the best entrepreneurs they see. Because what, they get 40, I think this season they got 44,000 applicants. And so it's competitive to get on the show, and everyone, because of how successful the show is, everyone's trying to get on it. But it definitely is a process to get to apply and to get approved. I think the statistics are astounding. I think this season 10, what they published is that 44,000 people applied to be on the show. 158 of those people made it to LA to actually film a segment. But then 88 of those people made it to TV. So like 158 film and 88 people made it to TV. So about half the people that filmed got cut. And so you can go to LA, go to the stage, you can pitch to sharks, film your episode, and then just get cut off and not actually have it come to fruition.
That would be pretty disappointing.
So tell me about it. So that's what that's what I was worried about, is we filmed in the summer, and I said, like, oh my God, am I going to be on TV? We had no idea what was going to happen. And so that's what I was concerned about. It's like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Then we got the news that we were going to be on in January, and it was very relieving.
Imagine unlocking a version of yourself that's unstoppable, where mental barriers no longer hold you back. Listen to Mentally Stronger with me, Amy Morin, therapist and international best-selling author, here to guide you on a journey to reaching your greatest potential. Every Monday, I bring you into conversations with some of the most fascinating minds, experts, authors, entrepreneurs, athletes, and musicians. They don't just share stories, they reveal the mental strategies that propelled them to the top. But here's the real magic. At the end of each episode, I break down their wisdom into practical therapist-approved advice. In my solo episodes, I dive deep into the techniques that build mental strength. It's like having your own personal therapy session as you discover how to turn these insights into steps you can take right now. This podcast isn't just for those facing mental health challenges. It's for anyone who wants to push their limits, achieve peak performance, and truly thrive. Are you ready to unlock your full potential? Then it's time to become mentally stronger. Subscribe to Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin, available wherever you love to listen to podcasts.
So it's a long process. I mean, they're taking applications now for next season. right? So like, what is it? It's January. And so they're already saying they're already doing casting calls and taking applications. So it's, you know, that's for season 11 and they haven't even finished filming season 10 yet. Or not filming. They haven't finished airing season 10 yet. So you can imagine it's a long road to get there.
Right. Yeah. So your show actually is season 10, which we're in right now, episode 9. Mm-hmm. And that went on the air on January the 6th, 2019. So just a few weeks ago. When did you actually record that episode?
That was over the summer. Shark Tank films the entire season in two segments. They do one in a week in June and a week in September. I believe that's what they publish. So, it's a crazy.
So you filmed in June and it went. It got on the air in January. So it's like 6 months roughly. Mm-hmm. How many times did you practice that pitch?
Oh my gosh, I can't even tell you. I thought a lot because. You know, I had the pitch written. I decided this is what I'm going to say to the sharks. And I, you know, would literally be in the mirror going, "Hi, sharks. My name is Max Fieber from, you know, I'm 15 years or not. I'm 18 years old." Right. So I would just go through it. And I did it hundreds of times. I mean, I there's a folder on my computer of me doing, I did it instead of doing it in the mirror. I did it in front of my webcam or my Mac so I could see, so I could do it, then play it back and say, "Oh, I'm going to tweak this. I'm going to say it slower." So I could actually, you know, evolve it. And so by the time I got to TV, it was pretty public, it was pretty polished.
Because you want it to be second nature. You don't have to be thinking to try to remember your lines or something. How nervous were you walking down that hallway? I mean, what were you thinking?
So it was, oh my gosh, it was the craziest experience because the doors open and in my head is, the music, bup, 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 bup. They don't actually play it when you're recording with them. But in my head, the music was going and I was walking down. I was like, oh my gosh, this is finally happening. And then all of a sudden I see the five sharks sitting in front of me. And I was like, wow, it hit me a little bit that I'd finally made it into the room that I had been always watching. And it didn't I filmed for a lot of TV shows. I filmed for TV shows before, not Shark Tank specifically. And when you're there, you're like, oh, I can't believe this is how it looks on TV. Like it feels like you realize you're on a set or it doesn't look real. But like when you're on the Shark Tank set, especially when I was there, I just completely felt natural in that room. Right? I was standing on the carpet in front of the sharks and I was like, oh, I have imagined what this feels like forever. And it didn't feel like I was in a foreign environment. It felt like I was walking into the TV that I'd been watching forever. And I think that's
because the set doesn't really change other than the product being shown.
But it's
pretty much the same.
And it's also like, it didn't feel like it was fake. It felt like I was truly walking into what I had been watching forever. It felt like stepping into, it was like very nostalgic. It was a great experience.
Did you want a particular shark to give you a deal going in?
I really liked all of them and I really respect all the sharks. I didn't have anyone specifically that I said, oh, I want Mark Cuban. I mean, I love Mark Cuban. I did want Mark Cuban going in, but if, he didn't give me a deal and Robert had given me a deal, I would have been like, oh, no, like it wouldn't have been the end of the world because I do respect them all so highly or so much. But, I like all of them, but I wanted Mark. I had my eye on Mark and I had my eye on Lori, but she didn't, end up giving me the offer.
So the sharks you presented to were pretty much the standard list. It was Mark, Damon, Kevin, Lori, and Robert. And now your proposal going in was you wanted $50,000 for 25% of your company.
Yes.
You did the product demo and it looked super smooth. I mean, I could tell when I watched it that you had obviously practiced that a lot. And so, I mean, obviously that paid off. Now, Kevin joked more than once that, wow, Max is really kind of amped up on the product. He's taking a lot of coffee.
Yeah.
Was that actually the case?
No. So that was actually one of the few mornings that I didn't drink any coffee. I was just very nervous and I was nervous and excited. And the combination led me to be very just energetic. And I'm normally a very energetic person. And so it let me be very articulate, but also very energetic. And I think they liked it.
Yeah. I think that came across very, very positive. And I can tell, I mean, just talking to you now, obviously you talk fast, you think fast and that's just the way you are.
Exactly.
Was there any question that you were afraid they were going to ask?
No, I was pretty much prepared for anything they could have thrown at me. I had been reviewing. I mean, I didn't necessarily review my numbers just because I know the number. Like, working in a business so regularly and every day, you kind of learn everything about it and you know everything about it, like, you know, very naturally. And so I didn't have to prepare too much. I just had to recalculate the cost of, you know, I just had to make sure we had actual numbers for what our product cost and what it, you know, stuff like that. But I wasn't really nervous for anything because I think in general, running Brew and running a company, I try to maintain a very healthy company. And I try to run a company that's morally strong and also very financially healthy. So we didn't have any debt. We didn't have any, we didn't really have anything too crazy that they saw. Like, it's not like they could have gotten my secrets out of me because we didn't really have anything to hide. I pretty much left it all on the table with them.
And you got your patent just before you filmed a few days, right?
No, I mean, that was true. We really had gotten, the patent really like 3 or 4 days before we were filming with them.
That was great because that's one of the things they always ask. And of course they always ask what does it cost you to make one of these? And you had all those answers ready to go.
Well, look, I mean, what was I going to say? Like, I'm not going to say I don't know. Like, I don't know the answer to how much it was going to cost. And I think that some people go into the tank and they say that. Like, oh, I don't know. I don't know how much it costs to make. And those people should not be on Shark. Like, they shouldn't be asking for an investment. Because they have
right.
No,
you wonder how they even got, how did they get past the first screeners,
right,
you know?
I don't know the process for how they get, you know, how they apply, but why should they be taking an investment? Like, they might not even know, they're not going to be able to manage that money properly if they don't know what their product costs, how they're, you know, they don't know the basics of their business. And they just, like, I wouldn't trust them with my money. And I can't imagine how one of those billionaires in the room felt.
Right. Because it's not like they just give their money out to anybody.
Right. It's
you know,
they're billionaires, but at the same time, it's like they're not like they're throwing their money away. Like, when they give you $50,000 on Shark Tank, it's not like they're spending it. You know, it's not like they're buying a car. They're investing it in you because they think they'll make money back. And so
right.
People don't really, you know, people forget that a lot. They think, oh, they're just giving this kid money to give him money. Like, they don't realize that, you know, Mark giving me $50,000 is Mark assuming that I'll be able to take that $50,000 and turn it into, you know, $5 million, which hopefully we're going to be able to do.
Right off the bat, Kevin offered you $50,000, but for a 50% stake. You didn't seem too excited about that.
Absurd. I couldn't believe it. That was just a stupid deal. I didn't like it. I mean, I respect Kevin O'Leary a lot. I think he's a nice guy. From me being in the Shark Tank with him, I think he's a good investor and I think he's a good person for the most part, but that was a stupid offer.
But you know, that seems like it's kind of his shtick, you know. I mean, he calls Mr. Wonderful, but it's like a sarcastic thing where, you know, he just comes out and he doesn't pull any punches, you know. He said, you know, I remember what he said about your product. If he thought, well, obviously if he was offering a deal, he must have thought it had potential. But
right, you know what? I didn't like the deal because it was too much equity for me. But in all honesty, like, he is probably one of the most shrewd investors there. And he's probably one of the fastest to say, your idea sucks. Like, you know, get out of here. You're the worst company ever. And he didn't say that to me. He actually, you know, he respected me enough to understand that we were running a healthy company and he believed in the product. And I do really appreciate that because I think that's very rare coming out of Mr. Wonderful.
But he said, I mean, on another one of the presentations on that same episode, I think the line he used was, you know, you need to take this product out back behind the barn and shoot it.
Right.
Because, I think a lot of that is for ratings because people want to see, you know, what's Kevin going to say next, right?
But you know what? I think that I don't know why he does it. I don't know why if they do it for ratings or not. I just know that, you know, getting an offer from Kevin O'Leary, he's probably one of the hardest sharks to get an offer from. He's impossible to get a good offer from, but I mean, to get an offer at all from him is really rare. So I think that the fact that when he gave me the offer, I immediately was like, you know what? This is, it made me feel like this product's legitimate. They're going to like it because if he likes it, then if like he doesn't have an issue with the financials, then nobody else is going to have an issue with the financials because for the most part, he's like, he's probably the most, out of all the sharks in the tank, when you watch him, if he even notices a little bit of a, you know, a deviation from what's normal in the industry, he'll slam you over it.
So you get that, and then Lori dropped out, and then Damon offered $50,000 for 30%. So it's a little bit more equity than what you initially wanted, and then Robert dropped out. And then Mark Cuban said, okay, I'll give you $50,000 for 30%, and I want an immediate answer.
Yes.
Did you feel pressured? Or, I mean, obviously that's part of the deal, is they want to put pressure on you. You know, we're going to give you this. You need to answer us now.
I don't know. Damon gave me the offer, and the offer he gave me was like, look, I'd want to license it. You know, he didn't seem to believe in me that much. Meanwhile, Mark's like, you remind me of me when I was a kid. You're a mini me. Like, I love you. I love this. And he gave me the same offer. And so again, I really respect Damon John. I think he's a great entrepreneur. And he was the entrepreneur in residence at my college, Babson, for a little while. But I think that, you know, Mark just seemed to have a little bit more belief in me than Damon did. And I think he was investing in the business, thinking he could make some money. And back to that, Mark was investing in me along with the business. Mm-hmm. And so I just really appreciated that. And I thought it was, I respected him and I wanted to do a deal with him. In retrospect, I probably could have asked the two of them to go in together. But I don't know if that would have ever materialized.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, since they were both offering the same deal, you know, for you to go with Mark, I guess that it makes sense about why you did that. Looking back on it now that since the show has now gone live, would you have done anything differently?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think I pretty much, you know, I think we hit it spot on. Made me look, I think it was good. I think they made me look really good and I really appreciated that. And I think they really portrayed the company very well. There's not much I would have, you know, done differently. I could have asked, other than asking Mark and Damon to maybe go in together, but otherwise.
But that wouldn't have necessarily been a positive though.
Right, exactly. So I would have asked the question. I don't even know if I would have. I go back and forth between it. I think about it because I'm like, well, Mark wanted me to commit immediately. And I committed and I did. And I think that shows something to him about how committed I was to him and to his company and to his investments. And on the other end, I don't know what Damon could add to the company because I haven't really interacted with him. So, you know, I go back and forth there, but I don't think I would change anything. I think it went really well.
They definitely reward decisiveness.
Yes, I agree.
After the show, did the deal actually happen? You got the $50,000?
It did. So we're working with Mark, which is really great.
How often do you talk with Mark?
You know, Mark's great. He answers the. He's a really good advisor, and I think I really appreciate it. He's a really strong advisor, and I'll probably email him like once a week to ask him questions or to give him updates. And he always is responsive, and you know, works with me and gives great advice. You know, which is awesome. He's really good to work with. He's a really good advisor and a really good mentor.
How many people have direct access to Mark Cuban?
Right. I mean, seriously. Oh my God. It's made me a celebrity in school and everywhere. They're like, oh, can you ask Mark a question for me? Oh, let me talk to Mark. Let me get Mark's phone number. I'm like, I can't.
Oh yeah. Like you're going to abuse that privilege.
Right. I'm like, right. Oh, and it's just, you know, it's great. It gets me into all the parties. Anytime I want to go to a party on campus, I'll be like, you don't let me in. I'm going to call Mark. And they're like, okay, come on. Not that I actually will, but it's been really cool. You know, seeing people support me and like me, and like the company, it's been really great.
You mentioned that just your appearance on the show had a pretty positive effect on sales. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So, we did really well. We aired on the show, and all of a sudden, we have thousands of new customers that just flooded in. And I realized that we were going to sell out as soon as we did better than I expected. And I was like, you know what, we're going to sell out. We're not going to be able to fulfill all of our orders immediately. And I said, well, if we can't be, you know, operationally excellent as it goes in the industry, like if we can't get all the orders out immediately and have perfect supply chain, then we have to be very on top of our customers. We have to be talking to them and interacting with them and build a community with them. And not that those are two mutually exclusive things, but, you know, we said like, we have to do something. We can't just leave these people to, you know, fend for themselves. And so I sent out an email to all of my customers with my personal cell phone number. And I said, look, you're my customers. You're supporting in me. You're paying me. Why shouldn't you have access to me? You know, it just didn't make sense. And so I said, call me. Call me, text me. It's my real number. It's the same one my mom has. And ask me your questions. Don't slam us online. Don't leave horrible reviews. Just call me. And I'm happy to talk to you about it. And that's what we've been doing. And it's been working very well for us.
People love transparency.
People love it. And I think that they really like, you know, they just, and it's really good. And they like it a lot. And they respect it a lot. And it helps build a stronger brand for us and helps build a community of all the people that, you know, that are on board and that, you know, respect us. And so I really like it. I really do appreciate it.
How do you, when you get the 50K, what do you use it for? What did you use it for?
So we invested a lot in marketing, like Market asked for, like he had wanted us to do. You know, but we did, we've done a lot of everything. We're just growing ourselves and we're, you know, spending a lot of money to grow ourselves as a company.
So it's kind of, I mean, what you're doing is kind of like bootstrapping, where the orders that you get, the money that you get from pre-ordering or from ordering is really paying to have the product created, right?
Right, exactly.
When Lori dropped out, she said this is just going to be, or she thought this is just going to be one of the many products that you'll develop. Do you have plans for any others right now, or are you focusing on just this one?
Look, I don't have anything definitive in the pipeline, but I do agree with her a lot. I think that, I've always viewed that this is not something I'm going to necessarily retire on, but it's just the first of many ventures for me that hopefully, you know, and now that I have this community of people around me that I have relationships with, with Mark and with all these 4,000 customers or 5,000 customers or a few thousand customers, you know, the number's not 4,000, but it's just whatever it is. Like, you know, you have this relationship with them. And so now because I'm giving them my phone number and because I'm building this community and because I'm kind of building this strong belief, not only in the product, but also in myself, I can say like, look, everyone, hi, thank you so much for believing in Brew. I'm starting this new thing. And whether that's 4 or 5 years out, I can say, would you support this? Because look what I'm doing. You believed in me from when I was a kid. Like, look what I'm doing now. And I think that it just, I think people are open, would be open to it. And I think people would believe in it. And I do really appreciate that.
Yeah. And what the network that you're building now, I mean, if you think about calculating the value of that over your lifetime, you know, that's a lot more than $50,000.
Right. Exactly. Obviously. I mean, even I said when Mark gave me the deal, I said, like, look, having access to Mark and having a relationship with Mark was so much more valuable to me than, you know, than anything else. I just said, like, I really appreciate him and I really value him. And Mark Cuban's worth a lot more than $50,000 to us. And so I had really, you know, I was very flexible in the amount of equity I was willing to give up. Don't tell him that. But
all right. Well, if he's listening to this, then, of course, now he knows.
Right. But now he knows. Okay. Mm-hmm. He could have gotten, no, not really, but I.
So you've got your website, you're on Facebook, you're on Twitter, you're on Instagram, and I'm going to have links to all of these on the show notes for this episode so people can contact you. What's the easiest way for someone to actually get the Brew cold brew coffee filter?
Best way to buy it is on our website, bruw.net. The best way, you know, that's the best way to do it. Coupon code is SAVE10 for 10% off. Don't tell your friends. It's a secret, but that's the best way that they can get a hold of one. And to get in contact with me, I'm on Instagram. You know, follow us on Instagram also at Brew Coffee, or follow me personally at Max B Feber. That's MaxBFeber. And follow me and, you know, DM me and reach out to me personally. And that's the best way to get in touch with me. If you want me to, you know, I love speaking and I love doing different, you know, I love doing everything. So please reach out to me and I'm happy to talk.
Yep. And like I said, I'll have links to all that on the website for this episode. And Max, I appreciate you coming on. It's an exciting story and I'm looking forward to seeing where it's going to go.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Max, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
The listeners have just heard your story from 5 years ago when you got that deal and you were working with Mark Cuban. And I remember at the time you were seeing a big influx of customers having gotten all that national publicity of just being on Shark Tank. I assume you were eventually able to catch up on all those orders, right?
Thankfully we were, yes. So, I mean, it was crazy, right? That was, I think, 5 years later, which is wild to think about that it's been so long. It was an unbelievable experience, and it was probably one of the most challenging scenarios of my career to date, where I had this massive spike in orders, which no amount of inventory management, no amount of order preparation could prepare me for, and it was really challenging. And I think, reflecting on it 5 years later, you know, while you're in the thick of it, you're really just doing the work, right? You're working, and you're running, and you're executing, and you're doing what you think you can do, and you don't necessarily respect the amount of effort you put towards something until you're looking back at it years later. And I'm very lucky to have been thinking about the scenario regularly, you know, and it's been great. It was really an amazing experience. But yeah, so I'll give you the update. We filled all those orders, thankfully, and I don't remember exactly where the story left off, but filled all those orders, and then I worked with Mark's team, and I continued to run the company for a year and a half. And then in May of 2020, I was lucky to exit the company to an acquisition to a company called Snarky Tea, who's also in the Shark Tank network. They've continued to run the brand, they've continued to sell the product, and I've been able to step back into new roles and to take on new opportunities.
And the exit, was that the plan from the start? I know it is with a lot of companies that with startups.
Look, I think that an exit is the plan with a lot of companies and they don't exit. And it's not the plan with a lot of companies and they do exit. It really doesn't matter. You know, whatever your plan is in the beginning, it's irrelevant 5 years in. Anyone who's run a company, who's run a program or knows anything, you know, who's run anything understands that it's really not relevant what you plan, you know, how your exit strategy day one. I think I didn't necessarily know what the company was going to become, whether it was going to stay a project, whether it was going to grow, whether it was going to be sold. It was hard for me to understand exactly what was going to happen. And so I was fortunate to realize that I was at this opportunity where I could, you know, really sell the company and make a good amount of money and walk away with this storybook ending to a great story of running a company through high school and college and then selling it. And that's more so what I was focused on, right? Is what's the natural conclusion to running Brew? Like, how can I continue to progress in my own career? And it ended up working out very well.
And you said you took other positions in the company after you left it, after you sold your equity in it. But did you have any other deals or ideas in the works at that point?
So I didn't take other roles. To be clear, I didn't take other roles within Snarky Tea. I, you know, detached. I was no longer invested in the operation of Brew, but I took other roles at other venture-backed startups and at other startups and at other companies, really to spend the time learning about other types of industries and other types of brands and learning about how the venture world works. I knew how to build a company. I knew how to build a product. I knew how to manage a team. I knew how to sell it. Where my weak point was understanding the financial structure of raising money for a company and kind of building a conventional venture-backable startup. So that's where I devoted a lot of my time to learning and took opportunities and took roles, which really just encouraged me to learn and be exposed to new industries and exposed to new work opportunities, and actually was able to leave about a year and a half ago from those opportunities and start a new company, which a co-founder and I are building now.
Yeah, that is, it is pretty amazing. You call it a storybook ending, and that's, in your case, I mean, you're still so young. It's like the storybook beginning still.
Yeah, right. It's like the prologue is over.
But I understand after being on the podcast 5 years ago, you have been in contact with one of the listeners of the podcast. What was that about?
That's correct. Okay, so I'm going to shout her out. She's going to appreciate it. Professor Quinn at Clark University in Worcester, Mass., is an avid listener of this podcast. She really likes it. And she actually sent me an email saying, hey, Max, I'm a professor at Clark University. We have an entrepreneurship program. My students would love if you would come and speak to us. And come and talk about your story being a student founder and how you balanced classes and school and you know, your social life and your company and all these different things. They're all running companies. They're all trying to break into the world of startups, and you know, they want some advice. And of course, I read this email. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, no one's going to listen to me. What am I qualified to speak about? Like, what is my story actually? How inspiring could my story be that people actually want to talk about it? Which, you know, fortunately is not true, but I think is the mindset that a lot of founders have. But, you know, and so I was like, yeah, absolutely, of course, I'll go. And I would love to speak to your kids. And so I went, I lectured for a day last year. And then last week, actually, I don't know when it's going to air, but as of, you know, the day we're recording it, I was at Clark in Worcester last week, spending a couple of days lecturing these classes, talking about my story, and also serving as a guest judge on a Clark Tank, which is their version of a Shark Tank, which was really fun. To see what some of their students
That's
are working
cool.
on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. But, you know, I have to tell you, and thinking back to what I did, you know, I said this again, that, you know, hindsight's 2020, reflecting on the company is really clear. Lecturing about it years later really forces you to deduce all of your thoughts into a clear structure, a clear outline, to know exactly, you know, what your takeaway and your analysis is, and talk about it to people. And so, you know, I was really lucky to be able to do that. And I think what I realized is that almost all of my job at running Brew and at running my current company is that you're playing this mental game, right? You are playing this mental game of entrepreneurship where you know, you are balancing your own emotions and you are balancing your stress and your pressures and, you know, you're putting out fires every day. And a predictor of success for a founder is not necessarily, you know, your ability to sit down and do all your emails and execute, execute, execute. Your predictor as a founder is your ability to just take a deep breath and know that it's going to be okay and manage all these different pressures and all these different stresses and move the ball forward. That's what I was able to speak to a lot of their students about, which was a really exciting opportunity.
And it must be an exciting opportunity for them as well. So, wow, shout out to Professor Quinn. Good job.
Yeah, she's great. She's really, she's great. She's going to love hearing this. But I mean, I was so beyond impressed with their entrepreneurship program. And I went to Babson, so I shouldn't be plugging other entrepreneurship programs, but I was really blown away with it. I thought they did a great job.
And now you have co-founded a new company called Bellwether. What is that?
That's correct. So we're building a company called Bellwether, which is designed to help brands leverage their existing social values as marketing engines. So what we figured out is that because of my background in direct consumer marketing, you know, running Grew for 5 years, I understood very clearly what it took to market a product. I also understood that right now, as of 2024, that's what year it is, it's hard to keep track, you know, we're in what people are calling this cookie apocalypse. Digital retargeting has become so incredibly challenging, right? There's a lot of data privacy regulations and social media networks are restricting, and there's a lot more content out there that's harder to break through. And so brands are trying to look towards new opportunities to market their products. And tangentially, at the exact same time, we're living in this era where people are incredibly driven by their social values, to the point where 80% of Gen Z and millennial consumers are actually willing to switch from brand A to brand B if brand B more closely aligns with their personally held values. And that's just an astounding statistic, right? And it's not surprising to anyone listening, but it's astounding. And regardless of your politics, it's something that the market is responding to. And so what we built, you know, I'll give you the really high level version of our product, is when you go to a website and you get a pop-up that said, enter your email, enter your email and we'll give you 10% off. Almost everyone clicks out of it, right? Nobody really goes through that. A couple of people go through it, but it's very low, that acquisition rate. And what we built is a pop-up that says, hey, enter your email or enter your phone number and we'll help you register to vote. We'll help you send a letter to your elected representative. We'll help you sign a petition. We'll help you take some sort of social cause. And again, it doesn't have to be political, right? It can be very generic to the brand. But what we found, and this is consistent with some other research, is that that actually acquires like almost 80% more cold leads, like 70-something percent more leads. And the leads that are acquired spend 40% more money over the course of their lifetime with the brand. So, right, it's this win-win where we have found a way to financially incentivize direct-to-consumer brands to really take their social impact seriously. So they can, you know, cause some form of positive social change while simultaneously increasing the amount of customers they have and the amount of money their customers spend, which is, you know, an unbelievable opportunity that we're building in.
Yeah, it sounds like the perfect storm. How did you come up with that? Who figured that out, that it would work?
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of smart people that are much smarter than I am that are researching in this space right now. Thankfully, there's a lot of people that don't read the same research that I do, that aren't taking it seriously. We see this going on where, right, that stat, the 77% or something and the 40%, that's, I think it was Harvard Business Review that put that study out. Don't cite me on that. But it was some either Harvard or McKinsey, somebody put that research out, which said 70 to 80%. More likely to go through a flow if you're engaging on an existing value. Our product is testing that hypothesis and confirming those numbers. But we're living in this time where people are really spending a lot of money and a lot of energy researching social responsibility because, you know, I don't have to tell you, the world is a little crazy, right? The amount of social engagement and political engagement that's going on, it's unlike anything we've seen in a really long time. You know, certainly nothing we've seen in my memorable lifetime. But, we think that where the world is for social responsibility right now is where the world was for sustainability and climate engagement 10 years ago, right? Nobody was investing in climate tech 10 years ago. No one was building climate companies 10 years ago. The few that broke through and the few that were are now crushing it and they're killing it. And now everyone's writing checks and you know, building these funds around climate tech and sustainability. But we really expect that in, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to be, you know, we're the first to market and at a really big opportunity, which I shouldn't be saying on a podcast, Scott, because now everyone's going to start competing with me. But
yeah, you know, the entire world's going to hear this episode. So, you know, you cat's out of the bag now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's Professor Quinn. If you're listening, don't steal my idea.
And how can people hearing this find out more about you and what you have going on?
Look, I'm available. All, you know, they can find me online. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. I'm all over the internet. I would say I would encourage them to send me an email, shoot me a text, DM me on Instagram or LinkedIn or one of those two. My Instagram is Max B, like boy, and then Fieber, my last name. And my LinkedIn is just Max Fieber. Just find me and reach out to me. And I say this and I mean it. Like, I really do take almost every call where somebody says, hey, I just really want to learn more about what you're doing. You know, and I was talking to these students the other day, and I told them this. I'm like, look, you're not going to take me up on this, but I want you to reach out to me. I want to be on calls with you. I want to help you. I want to talk to you. And so all it takes is them to reach out. And I'm really happy to. So I would encourage anyone listening to reach out and let's, you know, if you're in New York, let's grab coffee. Otherwise, let's hop on a call. And I'd love to chat about this.
And that's an offer that if anyone has any entrepreneurial leanings, that's something that people should absolutely take you up on. And when I'm in New York, maybe we can get together because I'll be up there sometime this summer, maybe.
Sounds good.
And for all of your contact info, we'll have that in the episode notes for your Instagram and LinkedIn and email, all that. That'll be in the episode notes so people can find that. And Max, I appreciate you coming back on. You've already done so much and looks like there's a whole lot more in your future.
Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to connecting in another 5.
Max is so genuine and down to earth. And when he says he wants you to contact him, he means it. He really enjoys helping other people, especially around the topic of starting or building a business. All of his contact info is in the episode notes at whatwasthatlike.com/176.
Hi, Scott. I love your podcast. Each story is better than the next, and you are such a wonderful host. So kind, empathetic, and wise. So thank you for that. Episode 170, Justin found his mother on Facebook, hit me hard, as we adopted our son at birth. He is 16 years old now. I just wanted to mention that the adoption agency we worked with changed our way of thinking about what it actually means when a birth mother chooses adoption for her child. Rather than give up her child, she makes an adoption plan for her child. I know it's just a simple change in a phrase, but I really think it more accurately describes the choice a birth mother is making. No woman wants to give up someone they carry in their body for 9 months. Rather, the birth mother realizes there may be someone out there who could give that child a better life, and that is what she chooses. It's an excruciating decision for her, and one that will forever change the course of the lives of so many individuals. It is also, in my opinion, one of the most selfless acts of love there is, which I know you understand. There are many people who continue to use the phrase giving up a child, and my stomach turns a bit each time I hear it. So I try to do my part in letting people know there is a more fitting phrase, and perhaps someday the standard language will become that a birth mother made an adoption plan for her child. Now, doesn't that sound so much nicer?
Been getting lots of good feedback about the Tuesday question episodes with Meredith. This past Tuesday, the question we talked about was, what's something you wish you could forget? And I told a personal story that I haven't shared here on the podcast previously. And of course, we always share the answers that come from you, the listeners. I have to tell you, Meredith and I are having a blast putting these together. And I wanted to clear up something about the podcast audio. I've gotten some feedback from a few listeners about a high-pitched screeching noise that can be heard right at the end of an ad break. The ones who heard it have called it jarring, scary, annoying, just not something you want to hear. So I wanted to let you know, that's not a sound that I include when I'm putting the episode together. It's something done by mistake by my hosting company. And fortunately, it only showed up in the audio for a very small percentage of listeners. I always listen to my own episodes on the day they go live, and I never heard it myself. But the good news is, by the time you hear this, hopefully it's resolved. I want to give a big shout out and thanks to my friend Alex way down in Cape Town, South Africa. She was kind enough to help me out by actually recording that awful noise and sending it to me so we could investigate it. So thanks very much, Alex. So it should be gone by now, but if you hear it, I'd really appreciate it if you could somehow record it and send it to me. Graphics for this episode were created by Bob Bretz. Full episode transcription was created by James Lai. And here we are once again at the listener story segment of the show. Why haven't you sent in your story yet? Just talk about something interesting that happened to you, just a 5 to 10 minute story, and email it to me. You can hear your own story right here on the podcast. This week's story is from a listener who had a bad feeling about someone, and she was right. Stay safe, and I'll see you in a week with a brand new episode.
Hi, Scott. My name is Gina. I was wanting to tell you kind of a freaky, scary thing that happened to me. It was in February 2013. The police in Southern California were on a manhunt for a man by the name of Christopher Dorner. You may have heard of him. About a half hour prior to it first being on the news, I had gone to get gas at an Arco gas station in Lake Elsinore, California. As I was standing in line at the register to pay for my gas, a man walked in, and I got the most terrible feeling inside of me. He was a tall, good-looking man, but when he looked at me, I knew he wasn't a good person. I immediately left. I knew in my heart that this guy was bad news. I didn't get gas. I got in my car and went home. That's how scared I was. I told my adult daughter about the feeling I had gotten when I saw that guy. About an hour after I told my daughter the story, we were watching the news and they flashed a picture of that exact man I had gotten that terrible feeling from at the gas station. I jumped up and said, "Oh my gosh, that's him. That's the man that I saw at the gas station." Christopher Dorner was a former LAPD police officer, and he was seeking revenge for losing his job. It all started on February 3rd, 2013, and ended on February 12th, 2013, when he killed himself during a standoff with the police in the San Bernardino community of Big Bear. He killed 4 people and himself. The victims were law enforcement officers and a daughter of one of the LAPD captains. There were 4 counties involved: Los Angeles County, Orange County, Riverside County, and San Bernardino County. At that time, it was the largest manhunt in Southern California history. I have an uncanny ability to know if someone is an evil or bad person. I've been that way since I was a young girl. It has happened to me several times, but never with a person as horrible as Christopher Dorner. Some of my friends say, "Oh my God, doesn't that bug you that you get those feelings?" And I said, "No, because, you know, sometimes that could probably save my life." Anyway, I hope you enjoyed my story.